Happy Monday and welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes, joined by our colleague Mona Charon, who is the host of her own podcast, Beg to Differ, which you can also find at the Bulwark. So again, happy Monday. It's going to be an interesting week, Mona.
Thank you, Charlie. It is going to be a very interesting week.
You know what I was thinking this morning? That that I was nostalgic for a time when the world was a coherent place. Do you know what I mean? When A happened, B would also happen. When somebody did something crazy, everybody would go, well, that's kind of crazy. As opposed to the world that we live in now.
Did you happen to see last week? I think I put it in Slack, but maybe I didn't. The Twitter message from John O'Sullivan, former editor of National Review magazine, responding to somebody and agreeing that they missed the times during the Trump administration because things were more sane. They said things were more sane during the Trump administration. You could say many things, but that is not the word I would choose.
I'm almost tempted to say I would like to sample the red pill that these guys must take. I would just like to try the drug to see if I can at least get some sort of coherence on all this because I don't know. So let's start with this weekend because there were a lot of interesting things that happened this weekend. Dan Crenshaw went back and forth on Meet the Press. Kevin McCarthy did his Dear Leader routine. Elise Stefanik also, you know, assured the world how awesome. Where should we start with all of this? Let's start with Kevin McCarthy. Kevin McCarthy is on comparing the awesomeness of Donald Trump with Joe Biden. Cut number one. Kevin McCarthy.
What observations did you see as it relates to the president? Did he seem engaged? Did he have a high level of energy? You've been around Donald Trump. You've been around Joe Biden. What's the difference between the two men?
Look, this is the first time I saw Joe Biden as president since he's been in. I saw him on the inaugural and the State of the Union night. He was with it, and he was engaging, and he was giving me numbers, and he was talking.
He was talking.
But at no time, having known Joe Biden for quite some time, does he have the energy of Donald Trump. We both know it. Donald Trump didn't need to sleep 5 hours a night, and he would be engaged. If you called Donald Trump, he'd get on the phone before staff would. He'd tell, bring other people down.
Awesome.
Superman.
That's right. This is how we evaluate folks, that Donald Trump didn't need sleep like normal mortals. Okay, so we might as well just follow this up with Elise Stefanik, who is doing her Elise Stefanik routine. She's on with Maria Bartiromo explaining why Donald Trump is so awesome and why we need to continue to follow him.
Yeah, real quick, Congressman, before you go, President Trump supported you to get the third highest rank in the GOP. How important is he to the party right now?
He's critical to the party. He is the leader of the Republican Party. Voters determine the leader of the Republican Party, and they continue to look to President Trump for his vision. And he's going to be an important part of us winning back the House in 2022.
All right, we will leave it there. Congrats again, Congresswoman.
Yeah.
We hope you'll come back.
We don't need Maria. I'm going.
Just remember what Maria Bartiromo is capable of, right? I mean, during the recount period, during the post-election period, she was on with Trump saying, "This is an outrage. This is the election is being stolen. Tell us more about it, dear leader."
I get feedback, I don't know whether you do as well, from people who say, why do you continue to talk about Donald Trump or feature and amplify the things he said? But I think it's important to remark on this Monday morning that former president of the United States, somebody told Elise that he's not the president anymore, he's the former president, that he was putting out one batshit crazy statement after another, implying the election was stolen, that Joe Biden is not legitimate, going on about Arizona. In fact, it apparently triggered the folks from Maricopa County who just had enough. I mean, they had seen enough. The Republican recorder of Maricopa County put out a tweet saying this is just unhinged. It's just one lie after another.
Let's elaborate on it.
Yeah,
because the way he said it was very affecting. He said, this is crazy. This is an outrage. He said the president put out a statement saying that the entire voter list of Maricopa County had been, what did he say, purged or eliminated or erased or something, yeah. Right? And this guy said, I am literally sitting at my computer staring at the voter lists right this minute. Okay. This has got to stop. It's unhinged. And Charlie, of course, you know, we can all say, yay, somebody told the basic truth. Hooray, we have a new Republican hero. And my reaction is, well, yeah, but how did we get to the point where those voices are practically nil? That the entire Republican Party, 70% of it, and most, almost all of the leadership are ready to say, yes, that this nuttery is completely mainstream now. And that's the amazing thing.
They're just asking questions, though. Yeah. They're just asking questions. So the guy that you quoted, he says, we cannot indulge these insane lies anymore as a party, as a state, as a country. This is as readily falsifiable as 2 + 2 = 5 if we don't call this out.
Yeah.
Well, maybe 2 + 2 = 5. Just asking questions. What if 2 + 2 = 5? Yep. What I'm not saying that lots of people are saying. There are lots of people who are saying this. Which, okay, so let's do the Dan Crenshaw. Dan Crenshaw, who I think is somewhat jealous of the of Elise Stefanik's sellout. I don't know what he's doing. So he's on with Chuck Todd, and Chuck Todd was just not having it. Let's play that.
You know, I understand you guys want to put this behind Chuck, you, but Chuck, he is the leader of your party, and he doesn't stop talking about this nonsense.
Chuck, the only... Look, he's one of many leaders in the party. He's a former president. We're 5 months into President Biden's presidency, and there is a time to move on. And look, you guys in the press love doing this, and I get it, right? The press is largely liberal, largely pro-Democrat.
No. Don't start that. There's nothing lazier than that.
There's a lot of reasons to keep this alive.
I understand what you're trying to appease.
There's a lot of people in my party that take the bait. I'm not going to take the bait here.
I'm not trying to bait you. I'm trying to figure out why do you appeal? Why do we sit here and have a political party that is basically rallying around this bizarre lie and mythology that the former president is doing? And you guys just want to say, hey, pay no attention to this. That somehow we in the press are bringing that up.
I already debunked the notion that there's no space in the party for that. Remember, Liz won that first election.
She's not there now.
She won that first leadership vote. Okay. Well, yeah, but I told you why. I helped you understand why. And what I'm trying to help you understand is that.
Yeah, there's plenty of space in the party. And, right. You know, he goes, see, but so here's the thing that you have to hold in your mind now. You have to think that, as Elise Stefanik says, he is, you know, well, Kevin McCarthy, he's the great leader who never sleeps. Elise Stefanik, you know, he is the heart and soul of our party. He's the leader of our party. And then Dan Crenshaw basically saying, yes, he's, well, he, you know, why are we still talking about him? We'll just pretend he doesn't. So at the same time, they want to cling to Trump while in some cases pretend that, you know, oh, why are you reading his tweets? We don't pay any attention to that, right?
Yeah. Right. Didn't you love what JVL said about the tweets? That was so brilliant.
Well, it was. Yeah.
Just to recap, he said throughout the Trump presidency, you had Republicans coming out and saying, well, you know, I don't judge Trump by his tweets. I mean, yeah, he tweets bad stuff, but, you know, look at the policies. The policies are what we're all about. And and yet, when it came to Elise Stefanik versus Liz Cheney, who is rock-ribbed conservative, right? Suddenly it was, oh, no, we can't have her. She's got to be booted out of leadership because she is because of her tweets, you know, leaving aside her policies. So,
forget the policies.
Right.
Yeah, it was always – so speaking of Liz Cheney – this woman is remarkable. I'm just sorry. She is not backing off. She went on Fox News. I mean, she is not hiding. She has not run to the MSNBC green room, raising my hand here. She's out there and she's answering questions very directly. The contrast between her and Crenshaw, I think, was kind of interesting. Anyway, so this is Liz Cheney on Fox News yesterday.
And I asked this about both McCarthy and Elise Stefanik. Are they being complicit in what you consider the Trump lies?
They are. And I'm not willing to do that. You know, I think that there are some things that have to be bigger than party, that have to be bigger than partisanship. Our oath to the Constitution is one of those. I've worked in countries around the world where you don't have a peaceful transition of power. What's happening right now with Donald Trump and his continued attacks on the Constitution and the rule of law is dangerous. And we all have an obligation to stand up against that.
Charlie, I have to say that I actually think, look, I was critical of Liz Cheney for not being anti-Trump when you and I were, okay? And she kept her head down and, you know, fine. But this action that she is taking now is about the least cynical thing I have ever seen from an American politician. She knows the stakes. She understands completely. She knew, of course, that she was going to be booted out of the leadership. She knows she's likely to lose or could lose her seat in Congress. She's willing to do it all because of the stakes, which she accurately perceives to be monumental, that this is really about our democratic system. It's about the legitimacy of our elections. It's about the continued health of our Constitution and our ability to govern ourselves. She sees it, and she is doing something that is a pure act of conscience. And I have to say, there must be more people out there like me who listen to that and get a little bit of a stirring in their soul, a little bit of the blood runs a little faster, and you suddenly feel like this is someone I could get behind.
Yeah. No, again, it is deeply uncynical. And I, you know, have to push back against some of the folks on the left who think, you know, well, because they disagree with her on a lot of different policies, that she's not really a hero. Look, if in fact, as I said, I've said this before on the podcast, if this attack on democracy and on truth is not is in fact an existential threat, then treat it like one. Yeah. You've had Will Salatin from Slate on your podcast too, right?
Yes.
He has a great piece in Slate about this, one of the best. And I just want to read one sentence. There's no magic force field around America that protects us from falling into anarchy or tyranny. What protects us, what makes us exceptional, in Cheney's words, is a system of elections, laws, and courts, which in turn relies on enduring popular support for these institutions. Cheney understands how easily this consensus can be shaken. And I think he's right about that. And you know, and he actually kind of connects the dots as she's a hawk because she stands up against authoritarian regimes around the world. Why would she not apply the same standard to our own government?
So this is it is a great point. And it's something that is ironic because one of the reasons that I was drawn to conservatism as opposed to liberalism is that it was always my feeling that democratic institutions, freedom, individual rights were precious and easily lost things. That civilization is really quite fragile, and that we have to protect it all the time. When Reagan talked about, you know, we're always one generation away from tyranny, that resonated with me. I agree with that. I think it's critical to maintain, you know, to understand that civilization is a fragile thing. And this democracy is a fragile thing. We've been unbelievably fortunate that it's lasted as long as it has. But most of them, as the founders knew when they were writing our Constitution, most democracies in history had devolved into tyranny. And so it is with particular misery that I look at people on the right who call themselves conservative and yet are being as radical as it is possible to be when they are, you know, playing dice with the Constitution and with our democratic system. They are risking it all. And that is about the most unconservative thing you can possibly do.
Well, I agree with you. So let's talk about, like, speaking of which, the most amazing stories over the weekend along these lines. By the way, the most amazing story is the 60 Minutes report about the UFOs, which I'm not going to get into. I mean, like, wow. I mean, Lordy, there are UFOs. I mean, that's kind of a big deal, right? I mean, we're distracted by a lot of other things, and yet we just suddenly find out, hey, by the way, we, you know, the U.S. Air Force believes that we have had visual sightings of alien spacecraft. I mean, you'd think that would be like top five story. It is.
Mentioned it on Beg to Differ last week or 2 weeks ago, and I got so much mail from people saying, yes, yes, do a whole podcast on this.
Okay, I'm really skeptical about all this stuff, except you saw I don't know if you've seen the videos yet from 60 Minutes and these pilots who are saying, look at this. This is like wild. And it's like, okay, I'm willing to take a break from Trump and this, you know, House of Representatives, all of this. I'm willing to focus on, you know, how we're going to handle Independence Day or whatever. So anyway, the other mind-blowing story to bring us back down to earth, Jonathan Swan over at Axios, that Trump's war with his generals, the one gobsmacking sentence from that was about the acting Secretary of Defense, Miller, whose first name I forget at the moment. Miller told associates that he had three goals for the final weeks of the Trump administration. Number one, no major war. Number two, no military coup. Number three, no troops fighting citizens on the streets. And so, wow, speaking of which, but in that story, it talks about how Trump basically said, let's get out of everything. Let's withdraw our troops from every place in the world. And just like he scrawled it on the back of something and, you know, handed it to the Defense Department. And they brought in this guy, this former general named Douglas MacGregor, to be the person who was going to implement the withdrawal from everywhere, who's going to, you know, run roughshod. He's the guy that Trump had nominated to be ambassador to Germany, and it went nowhere because Douglas MacGregor is a complete nut. But he was the president of the United States nominee to be ambassador to Germany. And over the weekend, this is where you say, people, I'm not exaggerating this. He writes an article for the super Trumpy American Greatness magazine, where he argues in favor of a military coup in France and suggests that we need one in America too. So when you and I are talking about the fragility of democracy, we are talking about people who are in positions of influence and potential authority who are openly talking about the possibility of overthrowing our democracy and having a military coup. And it's like, are you kidding? And they're doing it in broad daylight.
And I wonder if you polled the Republican Party members, you know, coup or no coup to support President Trump, how that would come out.
Oh, well, exactly. I mean, for people who think, are you serious about this? So Douglas MacGregor writes in American Greatness, which is very hyper-Trumpy. You know, Victor Davis Hanson, a lot of people like that write for it. Mm-hmm. He talks about the need for a military coup in France because they need to, you know, fight against globalism or something. In France, it seems the destiny now lies in the hands of its national military leadership. What Americans should be asking themselves as we watch the unfolding disaster from across the Atlantic is when, in all likelihood, not if, we will face the same predicament. It is painfully obvious that many, if not most, of the senior military leaders, like the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Mark Milley, are committed to globalism and multiculturalism. I would also say the Constitution and democracy. But one wonders what the majority of patriotic American soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines, along with the courageous police officers and firefighters across the country, will really think. What will these guardians of national order and security do when they confront more chaos and disorder on the scale of last summer's criminal violence against American symbols, citizens, and property in the months and years ahead?
So the woman who came in second in the gubernatorial race for the Republican nomination in the state of Virginia is somebody who openly declared after the election that Trump should declare martial law and impound all of the voting machines until they could, you know, figure out what the hell is going on, to coin a phrase. She came in second. She almost won.
Well, Lynn Wood got 28% of the vote to be the chairman of the South Carolina Republican Party. And he makes her seem like Demosthenes. So.
Yeah, well. Then.
Yes. So who's the bigger disappointment, Elise Stefanik or Dan Crenshaw?
Oh gosh, Crenshaw! I thought when he appeared on Saturday Night Live,
that was a bad choice.
What?
That was a bad choice. Go on. I'm sorry.
Well,
I'm reduced to mumbling to myself. So.
Okay, no. This is very when he was first elected, and he did this bit, you know, about we all have to get along and I mean, it was very sweet and nice and cross-partisanship and all of that. And I even tweeted it out, as I recall, that this is great, the way things ought to be. They're almost all bitter disappointments, almost all there. It's easier to count the people who are heroic, of course.
Well, that's right. It's a lot easier. Somebody asked that question over the weekend, and I said, number one, I think Elise Stefanik. Number two, Dan Crenshaw. Number three, rounding the curve, might be Mike Gallagher from Wisconsin.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I think mm-hmm. that Dan Crenshaw is really making a bid right now to be the Elise Stefaniks of Lindsey Graham's. So, yep. You know, stay tuned. All right. So given all of this going on, you and I both signed the same letter. Okay. Mm-hmm. So we signed that statement of a lot of people with former in front of their titles.
Yes.
The former official, signed that anti-Trump manifesto. Mm-hmm. Where they said it's time to either fix the Republican Party or move on. Lots of big names in all of that, and then us.
Yeah.
and I kind of had this feeling. I'm sitting back, looking at this, going, "Okay, you know, at what point do we recognize that there's no civil war anymore? It's done. It's over." And I think what triggered me is when I was reading that op-ed piece by our friends. These are people I admire greatly. I mean, people don't misunderstand me. And they wrote, "With Cheney's dismissal from House leadership, the battle for the soul of the Republican Party and our country is not over. It is just beginning." And I think, you know, that's just not true. I mean, in the terms of the Republican Party, it's over. The crackpots, the conspiracists, the Trumpists, they've won, and there's no point pretending that this is a party that can be salvaged. And so there's no civil war. There's just a purge. So, I mean, what does it take for our friends to realize you're not going to be able to fix this? I mean, how many signs do we need? How many canaries have to die? I mean, how many red lines?
I mean, I'm with you. Yeah. I saw that piece you did was it, MSNBC? It was a really good piece. I agree. I think the Republican Party has let it be known that it is a cult of personality now, and really, really thoroughly corrupt and dangerous to our society. But I signed that letter not to express hope for the Republican Party, but to express hope for the principles that they are upholding.
Right.
I'm not a political strategist. I don't know how this plays out, but I have to say that if there is a splinter movement within the Republican Party that peels off a certain number of voters of conscience, it makes it harder for Republicans to win elections, and I'm fine with that.
See, I am too. And at this point, I don't know what the strategy is, and I'm prepared to be wrong, and I'm prepared to be irrelevant. So if this means being an orphan, well, I've gotten used to it.
Right.
But also, I agree that, I mean, it's important to support people like Liz Cheney. It's important to support people like Adam Kinzinger. I would hope that they would commit that they wouldn't vote for Kevin McCarthy to be speaker after next year's election. But I think the notion that somehow this is going to fix itself anytime soon is more than a little naive. And by the way, Bill Kristol had a piece last week, and I was reluctant to engage with it because I get a little bit tired of always talking about elections and polls. I mean, is there a moment where we can actually govern? Like, do stuff before we have to think about the next election. I mean, mm-hmm, really? Mm-hmm. But there's straws in the wind out there that would suggest that the political atmosphere is very, very good for Republicans next year, despite all of the, you know, despite everything they're doing, despite the coups, the conspiracies, the lies, the purges and everything, that the generic ballot for Congress is pretty even. The Republicans have not lost support. There appears to be some evidence that right now, Trumpist Republicans are more engaged than any other political group. So the Republican calculation is we can do all this stuff and we're still going to win the majority because our people are going to turn out for us next year. So I don't know, do you have any thoughts on all of this? I mean, well, it's deeply cynical, but they may not be totally wrong.
They may not be wrong. I mean, I noticed over the weekend, I have one of my three sons was visiting this weekend, so I wasn't as plugged in as normal, but I did notice a story about these town hall and local Republican meetings throughout Georgia. Did you see that? Where newcomers are showing up, and they're not newcomers for the Democratic Party. They're newcomers for the Trumpy Party. So that's worrying, really worrying, you know, that this kind of thing is popular.
But I think it's important to talk about it now, and I don't want to depress people about this, but there's also a moment where you need to push back against the irrational exuberance or complacency that sometimes I sense. I mean, there's this sort of easy punditry of just assuming that when Republicans do stupid things that we live in a coherent world where people will regard it as stupid. Not necessarily.
No.
This stuff can actually work for them, and I think we need to acknowledge it. And you know, a lot of the cable commentary is the Republican Party is committing suicide, or it's, you know, in a death spiral. That's not necessarily true.
It's not at all true. I mean, they are more likely to win in 2022 than the Democrats are.
And the reason this is important is there's a faction of Democrats who think that they, because they have some evidence on their side, Biden's approval ratings are still high. Mm-hmm. Many of these policies poll well, but there sometimes can be a disconnect between those polls and what happens, you know, during an election. And this is one of the reasons why we need to keep raising our hands and saying these elections are decided by people who are, you know, the swing voters. They are more moderate than the squad. They are more moderate than the MSNBC green room. And that you need to keep that in mind. And there's that pedal to the metal group on the left that basically says, screw those people. We don't need them. Yep. Let's go as hard left as we can and indulge that id. And if they do, I think they are going to be the ones who are reaping the whirlwind. And they're constantly in there, and they're in their own bubble, where they don't understand that, you know, because, I mean, again, we absorb all this stuff and we assume that voters are looking at this and saying the same thing. Not necessarily.
No. And think back about 2020, this was a presidency that was a complete train wreck, arguably responsible for hundreds of thousands of excess deaths that were unnecessary from this pandemic. Complete craziness, right? And, pardoning war criminals and endless list of horrors came within, 44,000 votes in a few states to being reelected. But I ask you, what would have happened if the Democrats, if there had been, say, no violence after the George Floyd murder? What if there had not been a defund the police chant among Democrats? What if there had not been this effort to claim, I mean, that you can't write this out, but the argument that apparently had some purchase among the Hispanic voters, many of whom, you know, a surprising number of whom switched over to Trump, was the socialism argument. They are very resistant. They come from countries like Venezuela and other places, or, you know, Cuba, or, you know, they've had experience with the real thing, and they don't want anything that even smacks of socialism. And that's something that, you know, I don't think the Democrats get. I think even Joe Biden is, though he's pretty, you know, savvy about what is politically saleable, and you have to give credit for having perceived when almost nobody else in the Democratic field did, that the way to the nomination and to success in the general was sort of down the middle. But even he, you know, he's banking on this, you know, all this spending to give people stuff. And that once they see that, that's how they interpret government showing it can work, which means putting money in people's pockets. And maybe that's right. But I suspect that that's not the whole thing. I mean, a lot of people will pocket the money and say, yeah, but, you know, what about the transgender bathrooms, and what about, you know, socialism, and what about, you know, critical race theory. Yeah. I mean, and that's not to say that the left has to back away from everything it believes in, but there's a time for, you know, in certain districts, I mean, the parties are most successful when they're realistic and when they recognize that in Abigail Spanberger's district, you know, it's better to nominate a sort of center left Democrat who served in the CIA rather than somebody like AOC who wouldn't stand a chance in that district. So, anyway.
Well, exactly. And the other thing that, so this morning I'm listening to one of the cable channels that I'm not going to mention by name, but they have on an author who is explaining why defund the police is a good idea. And she's asked, well, you know, could you explain what you mean by defund police? And I'm not going to say that her argument didn't have certain really salient points, but it's like anytime you're explaining something that polls, you know, in the radioactive, you know, wavelength,
yeah.
You probably need to move on from all of that. So these things are very real dangers. And I'm getting the sense that they have people who are reassuring one another that none of that stuff hurt them. And they will benefit from pushing, you know, the most extreme. And I know the blowback I'm going to get on all this. But so my newsletter today is this actually working for the GOP? And I put a question mark behind that because I think it's early days. I think that one of the things we've realized is how our politics are contingent upon unpredictable events. All sorts of things can happen. Mm-hmm. But right now, the Republican base is maybe crazy, but they are engaged and they're motivated, and that's a reality.
Yeah.
So do you want to talk about what's going on with Israel and Palestine?
So it's got many, many layers of complication. Yeah. It seems like it was a perfect storm in the sense that it, you know, Ramadan is a lunar-based holiday, so it moves around in the calendar year, and it's in different seasons in different years. Not always, it's not like Christmas or Easter that are always at the same season. And so this year, it happened to coincide with Jerusalem Day, which is the day that Israel commemorates the reunification of Jerusalem after the Six-Day War, and in which some Israelis have taken to marching through the Arab neighborhoods, which maybe not such a nice thing to do, a little triumphalism there. But anyway, that was going on. The president of Israel, which is different from the prime minister, was giving a speech in honor of Jerusalem Day, and they asked the Waqf, which controls the Temple Mount area, which also where the Al-Aqsa Mosque is, they asked him to please turn down the microphone, you know, the loudspeakers that they use for the call to prayer. And they were turned down. So then a bunch of Israeli soldiers went up there and cut the cords.
Great.
Right. So, and then, you know, the rocks began to fall and the, you know, rubber bullets. And before you know it, so, you know, there's that. And then there's the fact that you've got Abbas in control of the West Bank, who is, what, 87 or something, and has been, or 89, and has been in his first four-year term for 17 years, completely undemocratic, obviously. And then you have Hamas in charge of Gaza, and they're bidding to be the true leaders of the Palestinians, and seeing the what they regard as the ineffectual Abbas weekend, they were hoping, you know, that to use this violence as an opportunity to rally people. And away we go. I mean, so, and then of course you have a prime minister in Israel who is unable to form a government and was just about to be booted out. And this violence is actually to his benefit
tremendous ways,
right?
Yeah.
So the whole thing is such a mess. But I will say this. There is this tendency it happens so often that it's just, you know, it's just a complete rut that reporters are in and commentators. Namely, they say, you know, so Hamas fires all these missiles into Israel indiscriminately, not caring right. whether they hit women and children. And that's, in fact, their goal is to hit civilians. Right. And Israel fires back and attempts to limit civilian casualties. But it's inevitable. They say Israel's using disproportionate force. And, you know, it's such an absurd thing to say. You know, if Mexico were firing missiles over the border, trying to kill us, you know, we would defend ourselves, and we have a right to defend ourselves. And so anyway, that's just annoying.
I agree with you. And there's a piece that I have not fully finished reading in The Atlantic by somebody named Maddie Friedman, What the Media Gets Wrong About Israel. The news tells us less about Israel than about the people writing the news.
Yeah. I think that was a piece from 2014.
Oh, it is. I'm sorry. You're correct. I am sorry. You are. Look, he's a former AP reporter, and that's the one I'm looking at right now.
Yes. And, it was a great piece. Yeah. Right.
Well, and it really does suggest the need to be somewhat skeptical about some of these narratives here. But what drives public opinion, of course, and emotions are those pictures of civilian casualties, watching a high rise building go down, you know, targeting a building that has media offices in it. And I'm sensing right now that whatever the merits of the case, this is not a public relations triumph for Israel right now. I'm seeing more negative commentary than I can recall in years.
Yeah.
More, so, and in part, it's because there are a lot of progressives who are willing to be very, very full-throated in their argument that we should not be pro-Israeli.
Right. And it's tearing the Democratic Party apart.
Right.
It's very, very clear. I mean, AOC and Bernie Sanders and so on have been very, very outspoken about this in a way, I agree, that's new. But let me just make the point, because I know it's been made endlessly, but it still needs to be said, that that Hamas fires at Israeli civilians and uses its own civilians as human shields, so that either way they win. They either kill Israelis, which is their goal, or they look sympathetic and get a propaganda victory if they lose their own people. So that's just a fact that we should never lose sight of. But the other thing that I would say here is, and my family had actually an argument about this the other night, was, you know, you could have predicted exactly what the international response was going to be to Israel destroying that building that had AP in it. And I just think that was their mistake. I mean, yeah, I understood that, you know, you shouldn't put your reporters in a building that Hamas also uses. Right. So AP has some guilt here, but Israel should not have done that, because it was just so clear that it was going to be a total propaganda. It couldn't have been, in my opinion, and I don't want to be an armchair general, but just seems like it probably, the military value of destroying the building is probably not outweighed by the propaganda loss of hitting some with Western journalists. Of course, nobody was in the building. They gave advance warning, you know, everybody got out, but.
Well, yeah. And part of the war is the war for world opinion.
It so is.
This is not an irrelevant thing. It's not like you had to do this, you know, despite the fallout from all of this. Okay, so speaking of the other issue that seems to be coming less clear than clear, I thought we had a moment. We were nearing a moment. It felt like we were nearing a moment of clarity last week when the CDC reversed itself and said, "Hey, you can take the masks off under these circumstances," and now, as a couple of days have gone on, it just seems more confusing. There are reports about how inconsistent the rollout was. The White House was not really given a heads up on it. People are going, wait. So the head of the CDC on one day testifies that she's not going to send her child to summer camp, and the next day says, okay to take off your masks, but not under certain circumstances. Now we're seeing one company after another saying, okay, we're dropping our mask mandate. Other doctors are saying this. Maybe where do you come down on all of this?
You know, I'll tell you, I did not think that I was upset about the poor leadership that the CDC has shown throughout this. Although it's been, I've commented on it, and it's been notable that they've made some big mistakes right from the beginning. But you know, I figured, all right, you know, they that's disappointing, but. But then when they announced, you know, that if you're fully vaccinated, you can go maskless, I, you know, triumphantly tore off my mask. I was in the airport and I didn't wear it. And then when they reversed themselves or when they backtracked and so on, I really got annoyed and thought, look, we do rely on you. We do rely on you to give us, you know, information that we can act on, and don't screw it up. You know, just make up your minds and stop changing the story. I mean, it was really one of the worst aspects about this pandemic, honestly, and this was something that the Trump people said, but that doesn't mean it wasn't true, which is that in the early days, they didn't say, don't wear a mask because we need to husband our supplies for healthcare workers. They didn't say that. They said, it won't help you. It doesn't matter, you know? And that's terrible, right? They were lying.
That's the tell, that the noble lie that they're sort of gaming things out, or maybe they overthink things. So they're saying things because they're afraid that people won't understand them or won't behave in the way they want them to behave.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's a huge moment. And you kind of wonder whether or not they continue to say these things because they have some sort of, you know, tertiary motive that we don't necessarily, you know what I'm saying? It's
exactly.
Like, can you just be straight with us?
Exactly. Because,
okay, you're vaccinated, right? I mean, completely vaccinated.
Yes.
And the reality is that we are kind of super people now.
Yes, we are.
I mean, we are. And I was listening to a doctor earlier today saying, you know, we shouldn't be telling people that there are still, you know, dangers. They still need to be careful. You are not immune. I'm thinking, wait, okay. You know, what is the messaging? Either these vaccines work or they don't work. If they work, it should lead to dramatic changes in behavior and the risk factors, how much risk you are taking and how much risk you are willing to take. Don't say that the vaccines are this miracle drug that are amazingly effective, which I believe they are, and then say it doesn't have dramatic world life-changing consequences.
Absolutely.
And they can't seem to reconcile that.
Right. And furthermore, think about the incentives, right? We want the maximum number of people in this country to be vaccinated in order to get to herd immunity, right? For the sake of those people who, because of some underlying medical condition, and there are such people, cannot take the vaccine, right? So we want the maximum number of people to get vaccinated. And if the message is, yes, get vaccinated, but then, you know, you still kind of have to be careful and you have to wear a mask. That's not going to encourage people to do this thing, which should be liberating and is and can be if they'll just be honest.
I find it weird, and I understand that people have pushed back after I wrote a piece about bring on the vaccine passports, that maybe the term vaccine passport is not the right terminology. I know that Frank Luntz has said that he's tried that in focus groups, and people think of that as elitist. Okay, fine. I don't care what the term is, but proof of vaccination.
Mm-hmm.
The weird resistance and opposition to that, when in fact proof of vaccination has been a norm in our society for decades when it comes to children in schools, international travel, et cetera. If the goal is to incentivize people to get vaccines, to make people confident that they can return to these big venues, then isn't some sort of a proof of vaccine exactly the route we should be taking?
Absolutely. I have no problem with it. I raised three children and had to present their vaccination forms to the school every September. Meant the last thing we did in the summer was make sure they had that pediatrician visit, make sure they were up to date. I mean, it's just that simple.
Well, it is that simple. And, you know, all the pushback, well, you know, this is authoritarianism and this is the big government, big brother. Well, no, actually, I'm not talking about government doing it. I'm talking about private actors, private entities that would do it. If, in fact, you knew that you could only attend the NBA finals if you had proof of vaccination, or you could only go to, you know, certain sections of the ballpark and do that.
Yeah.
This is a carrot and a stick, but it's also rational that if I'm around people who are vaccinated, it's going to lead to a higher level of safety. Now, I understand that people say, well, why should you care? If you're vaccinated, you're Superman anyway, right?
Mm-hmm,
But there are people who are not able. I mean, look, there are still residual dangers out there to other people. And if I made the decision not to care about other people, you know, like Ron Johnson says, why should we care about our neighbor? Well, I don't know. I kind of thought that was one thing we did as a society. you know, then I think these things are still possible.
And by the way, I mean, there is a huge group of people who are vulnerable that we don't talk about much, but they're children under the age of 12, right? So the vaccines have been approved for those 12 to 17, I guess, but not yet for children younger than that. And while this particular virus is not nearly as dangerous for young people, that doesn't mean it's never dangerous for young people. There are cases of little kids getting it and little kids dying of it. So, you know, for their sake, even if it's a small number, it's worth it.
So what else is on your mind these days? What are you thinking about this week?
Well, I'm actually writing a piece for a new Jewish magazine that's edited by Brett Stevens. So I'm thinking Jewish thoughts.
Brett Stevens is editing his own magazine now?
Yes, he is. It's a new magazine called Sapir, S-A-P-I-R.
Oh,
just
my.
Had its first issue. Yes.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
I want to force myself to pay more attention to UFOs. but one last thought. I think it's going to be really interesting to see this vote this week in the House of Representatives on the 9/11 style commission for January 6th. That it has bipartisan support, but I'm willing to go on a limb and saying that the vast majority of Republicans are going to come out against it because they don't want to talk about January 6th. They want to memory hole it. They don't care to find out what the truth is, and they're going to protect Kevin McCarthy from having to testify under oath.
Wait, so, let me guess, Charlie. The commission is going to be rigged.
Of course it's going to be rigged. It's going, you know what I would like to do in a perfect world, in a perfect world, which we do not live in, if you've noticed, is when you have the Elise Stefanik's or the Dan Crenshaw's on, I would love to have one of the anchors hand him a copy, assuming this wasn't remote, of the latest missive from, you know, the Orange Versailles down in Mar-a-Lago, mm-hmm. and say, would you read that? Donald Trump wrote this? And at least, could you just read what he wrote there? And now I want you to comment on why you are in a party led by this man and why he should be the lodestar of the party. Because I think that there is that, we talked about this right at the beginning, that cognitive dissonance that, yes, we're with him, but we're going to pretend that he's not actually doing what he's doing.
Yeah.
You know, at some point that's got to come back together again, but who knows whether it will. So by the way, I just need to mention this. Kudos to Bill Kristol for giving me some good advice on TV binging shows.
Oh.
Because of Bill Kristol, I have gone through all three seasons of Broadchurch.
Oh,
I have
yeah.
gone through Hinterland as well, which is excellent. That's set in Wales.
Okay.
Shetland, which is set on the Shetland Islands. Which, if you want to go look on the map, it's interesting where the Shetland Islands are, and thanks to many of our listeners, overwhelming number of our listeners, who recommended watching the British police series Line of Duty, which is amazing. But I will warn people that Line of Duty is very different than the other ones, much much more intense, as opposed to the quieter tone of some of the other ones, but these are all absolutely outstanding series.
That
frankly, I would not have watched them had Bill not mentioned them. And he's also mentioning Scott and Bailey, which I've just I have it queued up. So for people who want ways of dropping out. So I don't know why I'm spending all my time watching murder shows, but you know, that's
No, it's a fantasy. No, listen, I want to say that I am always in need of something gripping, some gripping series to watch because I watch it while I'm exercising and I don't like exercising. So I want to be just taken away and have something that can completely distract me so I can get my exercise out of the way. And the thing that I used through, I think it was 5 or 6 seasons that I really liked was a French series called The Bureau, which I don't know if you've heard of, but it's incredibly well done. Now, it does have subtitles, so you have to pay attention. You can't look away, but the acting is tremendous. The stories, it's, you know, former spies have said it's very realistic. So, I you know, within reason, but I found that incredibly great drama, and it's a little violent for me, but not too much. So
yeah, if you're into hyper, I mean, that's why the Line of Duty, which is the British police thing, series is much more overtly violent, than the other mystery shows. Although I will say that Broadchurch and Hinterland are more gripping than some of the quieter, you know, doily and cucumber sandwich, British murder mystery. But okay, here's a confession.
Yeah.
And a warning, particularly when you're talking about Hinterland, which is set in Wales, and they'd have a Welsh version of it, which just blows my mind.
Oh, in Welsh?
Yeah, yes, in Welsh. They come up with two of the same series, they come up with two different versions, one in Welsh and one in English.
Interesting.
But they have heavy accents. Same thing with Shetland. That if you have the ability to have subtitles on, I know it's the English language, but my wife is really, really good with languages, but we look at each other going, you know, we would not be able to watch this without the subtitles, because otherwise it would be the constant, what did they just say? What? I missed that.
The most hilarious Saturday Night Live bit about asking for English subtitles for a British murder mystery.
Yes.
I'll have to find it and send it to you. It's hilarious.
Yeah.
Because we all have that issue. Yes.
Yeah. Absolutely required for the Welsh series and for the Shetland series. Just saying. Mona Charon, thank you so much for kicking off our week. I appreciate it very much.
My pleasure.
And thank you all for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow. And as you know, we'll do this all over again.